Good evening, everyone. Let's see. Oh, somebody set the recording to going. Thank you. So this is, as Doralee mentioned, this is the second of two talks on the Heart Sutra. And the talks are based on my reading of two books by the Buddhist scholar Donald Lopez. The first book he wrote was called The Heart Sutra Explained. And then he wrote a subsequent book, which is the one I've mostly read, which is Elaborations on Emptiness, Uses of the Heart Sutra. So my talk tonight is on, my reflections on this reading and my own insights. And I think this talk, assumes some passing familiarity with the Heart Sutra, at least. So most of the people on this call, I think, have that kind of at least passing familiarity, if not more intimate familiarity. In any circumstances, the Heart Sutra is perhaps not the easiest subject to talk about. Certainly looking at your, two inch by 1.5 inch pictures on this computer screen is perhaps for me not the most ideal way to, to communicate, because I can't get a feel for you, and how you're responding to the talk. But it's kind of difficult in that way. So, I was thinking the heart and, understanding the teaching of the Heart Sutra is kind of like this. It's you go up to somebody's door and you knock on the door, and somebody inside the house says, "There's nobody home." And your reaction is, "Oh, thank you. That's just what I was hoping for. I couldn't have asked for a better outcome of this visit. How wonderful." So, this is not the kind of social interaction that we usually kind of value. We don't value this idea that we should really appreciate it when there's nobody home. And yet, the teaching of the Heart Sutra is a teaching about appreciating just that, appreciating emptiness, appreciating the lack of own being in all phenomena. And instead of finding that a vacuity or a place where there's nothing happening, finding it actually a rich source of sustaining our life. So to come into appreciation of the Heart Sutra is, let's say it's counterintuitive, or you could say it's only intuitive. Only intuitive. In Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, there's a chapter called Believing in Nothing. Believing in nothing. And the first words of the chapter are from Suzuki Roshi. I've discovered that it is necessary, absolutely necessary, to believe in nothing. That is, we have to believe in something which has no form and no color, something that exists before all forms and colors appear. Believing in nothing doesn't mean that there's nothing to believe in. Believing in nothing is believing in the truth or the insight of emptiness, the truth or the insight of perfect wisdom, which we call, anyway, what they called in Sanskrit and which we still call today, Prajnaparamita. So according to Suzuki Roshi, he discovered it was very important to believe in emptiness, in this lack of own being, in this teaching that nothing exists from its own side. And there's a poem by Uchiyama Roshi that I thought gets somewhat at this sense of what is discovered in believing in nothing, or through believing in nothing. And this was written when he was 70 years old, and he was facing death when he wrote this poem. He had tuberculosis for 50 years. And he titled this poem, The Samadhi of the Treasury of Radiant Light. And it goes, it's a very short poem. Though poor, never poor. Though sick, never sick. Though aging, never aging. Though dying, never dying. Reality prior to division. Herein lies unlimited depth. Reality prior to division. Herein lies unlimited depth. So he had these, you know, really health difficulties through his life. He was always poor. Didn't have a lot of support from his temple, in his temple life, from lay people, and so he had a pretty hard life. But despite the superficial hardness of his life, he didn't let external circumstances define him because of this faith, I guess you would say, faith in the practice of emptiness, the insight of emptiness, the intimate encounter with stillness and silence. So I was grateful to receive in the intervening week since giving my first talk on this subject, I was great to receive a few questions. And so I would like to address those questions now. And one question, I think it wasn't so much of a question, it was the question to me was sort of, why did you not speak to the phrase that says, and thus relieved all suffering, as in when Avalokiteshvara, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty, and thus relieved all suffering. So this person noticed that I didn't speak to thus relieved all suffering. And I thought, yes, that was certainly an omission on my part. So I would like to submit or propose that the important word there is thus. Important word is thus. Thus relieved all suffering. The Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, had this great insight, seeing that all five components of the human personality, our mental and physical makeup, are empty, and he was he encountered that, he had that encounter thus. He had that encounter just so. In other words, he was just so with that insight. That insight was just so. So I would like to propose that this relief from suffering comes about when we have the insight that we are just so with ourselves, with everything that is coming up for us, and we are just so, we are just thus. The things that are coming, we just meet them as they are, whatever emotions, perceptions, formations, whatever comes from consciousness, we just meet that just so. And then when we practice that, at the same time we're practicing that, we meet other people just so. So what other people are bringing to us, their words, their responses to us, their own perceptions, formations, consciousness, what they're bringing to us, we are practicing being just so with those things. And we're practicing being just so with all phenomena in the world, just meeting phenomena as they're arising. And when we're doing that practice, that is meeting ourselves in the world just as we are, just as it is. And this is how all suffering is relieved. That's what I would propose. There are undoubtedly other explanations. It also is true that, it says that Avalokiteshvara saw that all five skandhas are empty. In other words, he saw that all five skandhas aren't really five skandhas. And then the further insight is all five skandhas aren't really five skandhas, and therefore there are five skandhas. This is the logic. This is the strange and wonderful logic of Prajnaparamita. We aren't really the way we are, and not being the way we are really lets us be the way we are, when we can really not be the way we are. So this is not necessarily amenable to, sort of straightforward, rational understanding. The other question that I got was, who is the protagonist of the Heart Sutra? Is it Avalokiteshvara, or is it in fact Prajnaparamita, the mother of all Buddhas? So for this answer, you need to know that the Prajnaparamita sutras, which are of which this is one, but there are many others, and almost all of them are much longer than this one. But those sutras, which appeared in about the first century, around the first century of the Common Era, those have been personified. The whole Prajnaparamita copus has been personified as the mother of all Buddhas. And so Prajnaparamita and our Dharma Center, which someday we will go back to, we have a beautiful statue of the mother of all Buddhas, Prajnaparamita. So in a sense, you know, this whole corpus is thought to be, you know, preached or originated by Prajnaparamita. Nevertheless, my scholar friend here, Donald Lopez, thinks in this particular case, the speaker, the one who has the insight, is the protagonist of the sutra. In other words, that this sutra is actually preached by Avalokiteshvara. And this is the only sutra in all of that great corpus of literature that Avalokiteshvara plays, even appears in, let alone plays the leading role. So, this is, whether we want to, I don't know if it's really necessary to get involved in, arguing about who the protagonist is, but I lay it out to you as these are the two alternatives, and it wouldn't be wrong, of course, to understand all Prajnaparamita literature as the output, in a way, of the mother of all Buddhas. So last week we ended a discussion I was talking about form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form, form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form, which I mentioned is called the fourfold profundity by latter-day scholars. And I came across another commentary on from a Tibetan commentator on those lines that I think is quite wonderful. And the commentator is Vajrapani, very famous Tibetan commentator. And I'm going to try to read his words very slowly and carefully because they're not, the syntax is a little unusual. So you have to kind of listen closely and go slow. So I'm going to try to do that. Vajrapani says, and again, these words are in relationship to the fourfold profundity. He says, in order to become accustomed to viewing persons and phenomena as selfless, one becomes accustomed to not finding a self. By investigating and examining the minute particles of all internal and external phenomena, so there's a principle there in that's announced, which is the principle is becoming accustomed to not finding a self. And then there's a method that's described of investigating and examining the minute particles of all internal and external phenomena. So there's quite a bit there just in that first sentence. And he says, as a result of practicing this method, when the mind is placed in meditative equipoise, it does not observe anything or conceive of anything. When one has the goal of placing the mind there for a prolonged period, one is in a state of meditative equipoise, observing the clear and joyous mind. At the time of subsequent attainment, and I have to pause there, this time of subsequent attainment is, what was just talked about was Zazen, okay, was sitting meditation, meditative equipoise. The time of subsequent attainment is the time of arising from your cushion and meeting the world again. He says, at the time of subsequent attainment, all phenomena are observed to be like illusions, like dreams, like mirages, like echoes, like a moon in water, like rainbows, like a city of Gandharvas, like the wheel of a firebrand, like matted hair, like Indra's net, and the aspect of an emanation. For the sake of persons who, having done that, have interest in the arising of the mind that realizes the union of phenomena and emptiness, it is said about those persons, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. So when we sit in our sitting meditation, when we sit in Zazen, forms resolve into emptiness. When we get up from Zazen, forms reappear, but we meet them in a new way. Now, according to Vajrapani, we meet them with an understanding of their elusive or illusory qualities. And we don't have to imagine that forms are, you know, we don't have to go around in our daily lives seeing forms as illusory. But it might not hurt to remember that they are impermanent and selfless. When we meet phenomena that way, when a person who is interested in this dual practice or practice of principle and practice of being in the world, that's what I mean by dual, this two-sided Janus-faced practice of sitting meditation and being in this world, that kind of person who is interested in both aspects of that life, that person who's really engaged in that kind of endeavor very consciously, uprightly, that person is called a bodhisattva, or sometimes we say child of Buddha. That kind of person who wants to do that, who wants to go, who wants to spend some time in meditative equipoise, observing the clear mind, the joyous mind, and then who wants to get up from his cushion or her cushion and see what the world looks like and see how we can act compassionately and carefully and, yeah, with great care in the world. How can we do that? That's what a person who aspires to be a bodhisattva wants to do. Vajrapani says again, in order to become accustomed to viewing persons and phenomena as selfless, one becomes accustomed to not finding the self. Through investigating and examining the minute particles of all internal and external phenomena. I think this is a wonderful summation of form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. So now I'm going to move on. And I'm going to talk about, we just talked about or reviewed the fourfold profundity. And now I'm going to talk about what the commentators like to call the eightfold profundity. And that is the lines where it says, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. There's two. They neither arise nor cease. That's four. Are not defiled nor pure. That's six. Neither increase nor decrease. That's eight. So to understand the significance of this line, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, or neither defile nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. I think there it is helpful to bring to mind the teaching of the two truths, the teaching that we have the possibility of viewing things from the standpoint of conventional reality and from the standpoint of ultimate reality. We have this the opportunity to view things from the standpoint of ordinary, everyday perception of me and everything else. I am separate, and there's all these things out there. That's one way of viewing things. And then there's the ultimate way of viewing things, which is there is no separation between this and out there. No, the teaching, this is the teaching of no separation. So it's helpful to keep that in mind. Two views of reality, two views of truth. Now, the sutra says all dharmas are marked by emptiness. From the standpoint of conventional truth, dharmas, I'm going to give you three synonyms for, or two synonyms for dharmas. First, there's dharmas, and then there's phenomena, and then there's things. So when you're reading Buddhist texts, you might keep those three in mind because they all are used interchangeably depending on who's writing. But they all mean the same thing. Dharmas, things, phenomena, discrete appearances in the world, you could think of. So from the standpoint of conventional truth, dharmas, things, phenomena are all real, and they're capable of being grasped. You know, I've got a bell here, and I just grasped it. That's phenomena, and it can be grasped. In fact, the teaching there is that all dharmas are characterized or marked, that's two other two synonyms, characterized or marked by emptiness, meaning they can't be grasped. In emptiness, they can't be grasped. So similarly, for the other three pairs, the sutra says dharmas neither arise or cease in the conventional view. Dharmas are always being born. Things are always being born. They're persisting for a while and they're passing away. And we see this happening all the time. And that's conventional view. And the ultimate view is that process is not, elusive or illusory. That in fact, there is no cessation or production, no production or sensation, cessation. The sutra says all dharmas are neither defiled nor pure. From the standpoint of conventional truth and the teachings in the Abhidharma, dharmas are classified, categorized as wholesome or unwholesome. This is it. So this is a prior teaching, or anyway, it's a teaching in Buddhism that dharmas are either unwholesome or wholesome. Oh, there's a category of actually neutral dharmas too, and but when considered from the ultimate standpoint, dharmas, things, phenomena can't be divided up that way. They aren't divided up that way. They are neither wholesome or unwholesome, neither pure or defiled. And finally, the sutra says, all dharmas neither increase nor decrease. And this is an interesting one because according to several of the commentators, increasing or decreasing refers to Buddhas and sentient beings. So in conventional standpoint, we would somehow increase to be a Buddha from the state of sentient beings. But according to this teaching somewhere, and I think this phrase came to me from our studies in Dogen a little while ago, where one of the teachers we were reading said, it is not more in Buddhas and less in sentient beings. It is not more. So, you know, enlightenment or I think the reference there actually was to Buddha nature. When I think about where that came from, I think that the reference was to Buddha nature, but I think it can be applied here. It's not more in Buddhas nor less in sentient beings. It doesn't increase or decrease. So all of these pairs, each of these pairs presents, I think the overall presentation of them is creates a kind of feeling of a stability, a kind of stable, constant Dharma realm where things aren't vacillating so much, you know. It's kind of a stability in not increasing or decreasing, not being defiled or pure, not coming or going. So this is the kind of stable, constant Dharma realm that I think is being evoked by the sutra at that point. A sutra says, one does not stir from the nature of phenomena. One who does not stir from the nature of phenomena sees the nature of phenomena. One who sees the nature of phenomena does not get involved in the slightest conceptual elaboration. So this practice of not stirring is just things as they are, moment after moment. Not increasing, decreasing. Not arising, ceasing. So I'd like to say at this point who is the Heart Sutra written for? And I would submit that the Heart Sutra is written for beings who are not established in emptiness, as an encouragement to beings to establish themselves in emptiness, to found themselves in this teaching of emptiness, to found themselves in this idea that if they went to a house and knocked on the door and somebody said, there's nobody home, they would say, thank you. That is so wonderful. I'm so happy and relieved and enlightened by that. It's so welcoming. It's so welcoming that there's no one here. A person who wants to explore that kind of experience is a person for whom this sutra is written. We have this kind of setup in the Heart Sutra where we talk about the five skandhas, and then we talk about this idea of emptiness. So I think for sentient beings, my general appraisal of myself and other people I meet is that I don't meet too many people who are overly established in emptiness, you know, that have really fallen off on the emptiness side. I think the people I meet mostly are sticking a little too, well, anyway, not too, but they're sticking a little to forms, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. So I think the Heart Sutra is written to encourage us to stick less to that side, to see the emptiness of the five skandhas, to live the emptiness of five skandhas, to help other people live the emptiness of five skandhas. I think it's written for us, in other words. It's not written for the enlightened ones exactly, although we are. So another way I was thinking about helping us frame the Heart Sutra was in light of Dogen's famous aphorism that to study the Buddhism, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And then there's a third part. To forget the self is to be lived by all beings, to be awakened with all beings. So one way to look at the Heart Sutra is that the early part of the teaching, where Avalokiteshvara has the insight that form is emptiness, emptiness is form, and sees it. Well, first he sees this five skandhas are empty, and then he has this insight about how it is that they're empty, or how they appear as empty. And I think one way to look at that is that's a side of the self. It's a side, study the self, because the self is represented by the five skandhas. That's what's, you know, represents the self in this sutra. The five skandhas are empty, but nevertheless, there's this teaching that we shouldn't mistake even these categories of Buddhist analysis for a self. So we that's how we're encouraged in the first part of the sutra, and then we come to the second part, which begins with the negations of what is not found in emptiness. And that's the part where I would say it's talking about, and to study the self is to forget the self. Study the self is to forget the self. So then we come to the negations section of the sutra. Therefore, it says, therefore, given emptiness, there is no feeling, no form, no feeling, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no so on. We know that part. And I wonder if you can hear that there's a kind of shift in the sutra at that point. At the sutra, the shift that I'm talking about towards this idea that this is a teaching for our meditation practice itself. This is a teaching for not finding phenomena in our sitting, letting go of phenomena, letting go of dharmas, letting go of all these categories of Buddhism, letting go of Buddhism, period. And I was heartened because I've always thought there's kind of a shift there. There's kind of a turning towards our meditation practice there. And then I read one of the commentators, a Tibetan commentator whose name I could not possibly pronounce. But there was a quote that I came across in the study that I was looking at. And he says, here the Bodhisattva enters repeatedly into samadhi in which the only thing that appears is emptiness. No conventional phenomena appear at that time, such that there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, etc. And this interpretation is also supported by Vimalamitra, who is one of the other commentators, an Indian commentator. And he says, seeing emptiness thoroughly is to be understood as thoroughly not seeing form. Seeing emptiness thoroughly is to be understood as thoroughly not seeing form, not see any phenomena. To not see any phenomena is to see emptiness. So then we come to the negations of the sutra, and I'm not going to go through all of those. There are about six categories. Maybe I'll go through the categories really quick. So the categories of the negations are, one, the five skandhas, two, the six senses, three, the six sense objects, four, the six sense consciousnesses, then the negation of the 12-fold chain of causation, and that's I don't know if you know this teaching about the 12-fold chain. We've talked about the wheel of causation maybe a year ago or something. We talked about it, but anyway, the wheel of causation starts with ignorance and goes around the circle and ends at old age and death. And so there's the positive turning of that circle, and then there's a negative turning of that circle, which is a synonym, a kind of teaching on enlightenment, in which you extinct each link of the chain and back till finally extincting ignorance. But the Heart Sutra actually says, well, that's not it either. That's not it either. And it's not just, you know, this isn't the right description, and the counterclockwise is not the right description either. And finally, I've lost track. But anyway, Four Noble Truths are negated. The Four Noble Truths are negated. And the final negation is no knowledge and no attainment, which is negating the supramundane path of liberation. Anyway, the negations wipe out Buddhism. Buddhism is completely wiped off the map. And that's kind of the point. That's kind of the point. Because the Heart Sutra is, you know, encouraging us not, you know, this is the wonderful thing that many people find attractive about Buddhism. This is the Buddhism is the religion that negates itself and says, you see for yourself, you find out, you discover something. Like Suzuki Roshi, you know, he discovered something. He discovered that it was very important to believe in nothing. That's what he said, that was his discovery. So this is what the Heart Sutra is encouraging, you know. Forget out, you know, get Buddhism. It's up to you. You make your own discovery. And Suzuki Roshi, you know, the next line is, you know, after the negations, it says, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita. And, you know, this was a very important point for Suzuki Roshi. He was always talking about not practicing with a gaining mind, not practicing that we were going to attain some great liberation. So I'm coming to the end, believe it or not. So have faith, don't despair. It says, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita. And what a bodhisattva relies on the perfection of wisdom. So relying on the perfection of wisdom is like relying on space. And this is an analogy that's used, right? For perfection of wisdom, space. You know, we absolutely depend on space. How could we walk from this room that I'm in into the next room without space? You know, we completely depend on space, but we can't see it. We can't apprehend it. We can't get a hold of it. So this is a good analogy. Space is a wonderful analogy for Prajnaparamita, and it's one that's used frequently. Air is also, you know, we're totally dependent on air, right, to breathe. But we can't see it. We can't grab it. We can't get a hold of it. But we're totally dependent on, we're totally inseparable from space, from air. And those are just the things that it's easy in our mind to see that we're inseparable from. That's just making it easy for us to see those things. And then it says, Bodhisattva relies on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every inverted view, one dwells in nirvana. Without hindrance is interesting word. It's a Sanskrit. It is citta avarana, and it means without thought coverings. So when a person practicing Prajnaparamita has a mind that is without thought coverings, no fears exist. And they're far apart from every inverted views, every inverted view. And I don't know if you know what inverted views are, but I will say, because it's a good thing to know what inverted views are. So right view, you know, the Eightfold Path, right? And right view, or one of the ways of characterizing right view is to see that they are, things are permanent, impermanent, selfless, and they are characterized, inevitably linked with suffering. Because they're impermanent, basically. So impermanent, selfless, linked to suffering. So the inverted views are just the opposite of that. That's seeing things as permanent, things seeing things as having a self, things seeing phenomena as pleasant when we really should see them as unpleasant and characterized by suffering. So those are the inverted views that we're far apart from when practicing deeply Prajnaparamita. So last thing, the rest of the sutra is just a kind of leading up to the mantra. So maybe just because it's getting late and maybe we'll have a few questions or not, but I'll just skip to the mantra. It says, gate, gate, paragate, Parasamgate Bodhisvaha. And that literal translation is gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond Bodhi, enlightenment. What a relief. Svaha, what a relief. What a great outcome. Some people say hallelujah. I don't know. I don't like hallelujah. Svaha. But most of the time, the mantra is never translated, you know, in recitation. No, nobody translates the mantra, you know, in recitation at least. And I did come across one other translation, which I had never heard, but I kind of liked quite a lot. And this Tibetan commentator said, he translated it, proceed, proceed, proceed beyond, proceed far beyond. Be founded in enlightenment. Be founded in enlightenment. And I think that's very good. I like that a lot. And I think that's exactly, that is what the Heart Sutra is written for, is to encourage us to be, you know, to practice, to be founded in enlightenment. And you know, this idea of proceed, proceed, you know, gives this idea that we always talk about, of, you know, the path is endless, you know, just keep going. It's an endless path. Practice and enlightenment go on in this life and throughout countless lives. So That is my disquisition on the Heart Sutra tonight. Thank you so much for your attention, patience. And it's been really interesting for me to, I was going to give these talks earlier in the year, but then we had the pandemic and I thought, oh, I couldn't possibly give these talks on Zoom. But now I have the courage and I did it. And thank you for your patience in hearing them. And if we want to spend a few questions, we could maybe do a few questions. People are bowing, so maybe there's no questions. No, there's a question. Okay, Dell. Dell will have to...
Yes, I just unmuted. I figured it out. I am curious if you would mind spelling the Tibetan commentator's name.
Oh,
if you have
Vajrapani, that one, Vajrapani.
No. The one you said you didn't want to try to pronounce.
Oh no, I couldn't. I can't spell it because I didn't write it down.
Oh,
Gail, I will send you an email with that name in it.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you.
It's one of these names. You know. It's Tibetan, and I can't. It doesn't have any English equivalent, so I don't even know how to approach it for translation.
Yeah, it's hard. It's a hard language.
Yeah, but I can send it to you.
That would be great. Thank you,
Sarah.
Jim, thank you so much. I really appreciated you. Your tone in slowing down and going through those concepts. It was a lot of information, but it made it so easy to sort of give a little space, air, I guess, which is so important, to try to process what you were saying without you moving on quickly to another concept. And I really, really appreciate that pace for your talk. It was so helpful in learning. I do have a question or just an observation. It seems that for a sentient being who is truly enlightened is never going to know that, because you can't hold on to it. And if you hold on to it, you can't know that you're enlightened. But can another sentient being who is not enlightened see that in one who is?
Well, not being an enlightened person, I don't know that I can speak to that. Not being, I can't give a firsthand account. There's a phrase in Dogen that where he talks about Dharma transmission, and he says it can only occur between a Buddha and a Buddha. I think in Dharma transmission, there's at least a concept that there is this Buddha meeting Buddha, and for that to happen. But your question is a little bit over my head.
Unknowable.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining me tonight and joining us. And I think it's I like the idea that we would be chanting this sutra, this Heart Sutra, quite a bit. And so I'm happy to have a chance to talk about it and study it myself in preparation for these talks. Thank you very much.